I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Jessica Lowenthal, poet, teacher, editor, brilliant convener daily of poetic happenings, Drupal expert, associate publisher of Jacket 2 magazine, director of this very Kelly Writer's House, and author of As If in Turning, and by Randall Couch, a Poem Talk original. Welcome back, Randall. Poet, thanks. Editor, university administrator, teacher of writing and poetics at Arcadia University, editor and translator of the poems of Gabriela Mistral, published by Chicago. He has published essays and book chapters on Ezra Pound, Harriet Mullen, and on ethics and reception in poetry translation and other topics. And by Ron Silliman, who has written and edited more than 30 books, including The Alphabet, a 1,000-plus page poem in 26 parts, who is now engaged in another big project called Universe, and whose eponymous blog has been visited a number of times, well into the millions, and who has recently finished teaching a very successful course here at the Writer's House. Hello, everybody. Welcome back.
Hi, Al.
Hi, Al.
Randall, good to see you. Ron, how was the commute?
Today, the commute was terrible in Chester County and fine thereafter.
Did you listen to Du Plessis or Oppen on the way? Which one?
I listened to AM radio.
That I don't believe, but anyway. Okay, today the four of us are gathered to talk about two sections of Draft 85 Hard Copy. It's called Draft 85 : Hard Copy, which is the 85th section of Rachel Blau Du Plessis' ongoing long poem, Drafts. Draft 85 is itself a long poem, running from pages 42 to 71 in the book Pitch, Drafts 77 to 95. This big draft was written between February and May of 2007. All 40 sections of Draft 85 were recorded by the poet for Penn Sound in October 2007. We've decided to focus on two of those 40 sections, sections 16 and 29. So here now is Rachel Blau Du Plessis reading from Draft 85 Hard Copy.
16. I won't quote a word, but that notable double-crossing chess game reveals trouble in the desert, trouble in the lineage, trouble in the choices, trouble in the allegory. What more to say about the father of everything, from the inevitable, suspicious, atheist daughter, watching the claim made around the one, the beautiful, longed-for, pensive son? They are all male singletons. One A, one I, and one. Undercounting various brothers who do not matter in the tally, nor enumerating most sisters, though they certainly existed. Single, except for the one who sent an androgyne messenger, who rammed the ram into the thicket, who filled the curly ewe, who took her mewling newborn sheep. Thereupon, the regime of human sacrifice was declared theologically finished, but not politically and ideologically finished. Clear enough? 29. So, she stole her father's teraphim. What in the name of monotheism was that about? Those rare black stones, sacred knickknacks, idols, symbolic lion grabbed at that got chipped. Cover them with the ass of female claim. Settle in for the duration and refuse, being in the way of women, to rise. Say you are neither disloyal nor pilferer, and sit tight on the icons and rocks of meaning gathered from the paternal household, the talismanic counterfoils, even the fewest and smallest, from the fierce storehouses of articulation and defensiveness. You will remake these goods in your own blood. I didn't take enough, so go get more. Tokens from the broken labyrinth.
Okay, so let's put out some basic information about the contexts here. So we have this poem, draft 85 hard copy, is set in relation to what, Ron?
In relation to George Hopkins of Being Numerous, which was the title sequence in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book of 1969.
And Rachel Blau Duplessis, as a young poet, was sent a typescript copy of this in 1965. It was a very important turning point for her.
Right, in a version different from what was finally published, because actually some of Rachel's responses ended up in the
getting into the text.
That's right.
A little like Cress and William Carlos Williams in not Cress, but another character, Marcia mm-hmm. Nardi in Patterson. Randall, how does hard copy map with/against of Being Numerous, roughly in general terms?
Well, there are 40 sections in each poem, and Rachel responds in her poem section by section to concerns. The Of Being Numerous was Oppen's first book after A Long Silence, which we can talk about later, and the political reasons for that are some of the thematic material that Rachel explores in this poem.
So, Jessica, anything more to say about response? Randall used the general term response. Sometimes it's elaboration, sometimes it's sympathy, sometimes it's political congruence, sometimes it's rejoinder, sometimes it's critique. Any others?
Sometimes it's echo, using similar words. Sometimes it's taking a different subject position entirely, reversing the characters, as it were. Sometimes it's so linguistic, sometimes it's actual comment back, I think.
Okay, and before the four of us go into four different places with this, because we have so much to say, I'm personally very excited about this conversation. let's just state 16 and 29. 16, they're both allusive to biblical, important biblical stories. So let's just say what those two are. Anybody want to, what's 16 referring to?
The Binding of Isaac.
The Binding of Isaac. God saying to Abraham, I'm quoting Bob Dylan here, kill me a son.
Abe That's
said,
right.
Where you want this killing done? And I could go on. So this is from Genesis 22, chapters 22 and 25. Right, before we get back to 16, anybody want to add what the 29th section is in both cases? No, in one case.
In Rachel's for Rachel, it's Rachel steals her father's idols.
Not Rachel Blau Duplessis, but
well,
Rachel.
Maybe.
Well, in the Bible, not to break chronology, in the Bible, Rachel, Laban's daughter, wife
of Jacob,
steals the household idols, teraphim, from Laban. Okay, and George Oppen, in the first case, does refer to Abraham and Isaac in 16, but in the second case, Oppen's 29 is not about the biblical Rachel, but is about what?
His relationship with his own daughter.
His own daughter.
Right.
And Rachel Blau Duplessis has spoken many times about her relationship with her own father, who was, in her terms, I'm not making this up, a little less of a generous patriarchal figure than Oppen was, but they both serve. So Oppen was somewhat of a paternal figure poetically, and so it would make sense for her to respond to Oppen's section about his daughter by figuring herself as a biblical daughter who's breaking ranks, really, in the Judaic tradition. Okay, should we go to 16 or 29? Which should we go? Ron, you pick.
Oh, let's go to 16.
All right, talk about that. Why, okay. I won't quote a word. What's that refer to?
I'm actually not sure on that one, except that the entire poem is a paraphrase of the Appen, but also an allusion to, and Randall and I were talking about this before the program began, the most famous chess game in poetry, which is the second section of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, which is also a curious father in a negative sense, I think, throughout this entire poem.
So you've just complicated poem talk tremendously by adding Eliot into the mix. We can barely handle Appen, but fine.
Wait till we get to Pound.
And then there's Abraham. Oh, my goodness. Randall, what are you
going
to say?
I was just going to say that I recently had occasion to read Of Being Numerous with Rachel at the Temple Penn Poetics Reading Group, and one of the first things she mentioned in passing about this was that Of Being Numerous, the poem, was, quote, like our wasteland, meaning for her generation of poets. So this is completely, I think, legitimate.
All right, Eliot has been stipulated. Eliot's in there.
There's something totally perverse, actually. I'll just say this, not about 16 or 29, but about reading drafts in this way.
The whole poem or hard copy?
The way we are reading drafts, at focusing on 16 and then focusing on one allusion or one reference, because the poem is all about how do we read anything without reference to other things.
Can we go back to I Won't Quote a Word? Ron referred to this, but we should be more explicit. The Appen section, Randall, what is it? The 16th section of Being Numerous.
It's largely drawn from Kierkegaard.
It's in quotes.
Yeah, the whole thing, right.
Why would, just on the surface, superficially, why would Rachel, in her rejoinder/response, say, I won't quote a word, and then go on to deal with her own critique of the way in which the Abraham Isaac story has been told? Randall? Jessica? Why would she say, I won't quote a word? What kind of response is that to Appen?
Well, perhaps it's relevant that, as she has said, each draft in the series has its own individual textual marking, and this one, she says, is marked by overwriting. And so rather than quoting, she's going to create her own original remaking of
and maybe
the
going
same,
back
the same
to
issue.
A more originary and maybe more relevant to Rachel's source than Kierkegaard, which is a Christian reading of the foundational story of Judaism.
So you think I won't quote a word means I won't quote the Kierkegaard?
I'm not going to do what you did. I'm going to go back to Abraham and Isaac, and my problem is there's trouble in this lineage. There's a lot of lineages in drafts, so what are some? Nominations are open, Ron?
Well, I think all the names that we've already mentioned are clearly part of this.
Including Appen?
Appen, and as I say, including Pound and Eliot and all the other males to whom she is in relation as a young woman coming into poetry. We have to remember, hard copy begins in a section we're not reading with the date, which just happens to be the date she starts writing drafts, when she is literally, and this is a very un-Rachel image, sitting on Solana Beach in Southern California because she has just spent a day with the Appen Archives.
And elsewhere in hard copy, Ron, she says she thinks back on 40 years of the friendship. It's been 40 years since that moment when Appen reached out to her. So there's a lot of retrospective going on.
And 2 years since Appen's death at the in 84.
So what's going on with the ram there? Once we have an androgyne messenger. The idea that we should stop doing these sacrificing our sons as a test of faith. Now that messenger rams the ram into the thicket. What's going on there? Should I worry about that?
Well, that's how. I mean, are you want
ram
something,
the ram meaning
something
that's
more?
The sacrifice.
Yeah, something more than just the fact that that was the animal provided by Yahweh to.
Well, what's a ewe?
Replace.
It's a female ram.
Yes,
female
so,
sheep.
Okay, so this is not just a sacrifice. Because the ram is being rammed, and that ram filled the ewe.
Oh, I think the parallel structure suggests that it's the one who's filling the ewe.
I thought so too.
The one is impregnating the ewe.
Yeah, that
God is making newborn sheep.
Yeah, being fruitful, wow. making the flocks prosper.
Wow, he got around that right. Father of everything.
But this regime of human sacrifice is also a reference to the war in Iraq.
Sure.
Not to mention at least two other wars that we can think of.
They are all male singletons. One A, one I, and one. Undercounting various brothers who do not matter in the tally, nor enumerating most sisters, though they certainly existed. Single, except for the one who sent an androgyne messenger, who rammed the ram into the thicket, who filled the curly ewe, who took her mewling newborn sheep.
There are three male singletons, one A, one I, and one. Who are they? Let's be literal.
Abraham, Isaac, and Yahweh.
Right. And also the I could be the subject.
Yes.
Right. And yeah. Singleton, why, is that a negative word?
Well, it's a term clearly born out of looking at the entire question of gestation and parenting in a very critical sense. And Rachel has parented two children through adoption, so she doesn't have the simple reflexive attitude towards that, which as somebody who's had a similar history in my case through high technology births, I totally hear that reference there in those terms.
And she notes in the section 16 that these three male singletons is an that identifying them in the story, particularly as Oppen gets it from Kierkegaard, is to undercount various brothers, including Ishmael. Why is that significant? Didn't he theologically go off in a different direction?
Yes, Yahweh instructed him to be sent away.
And he created another branch of monotheism.
Oh, which Islam.
Which we were engaged in at the time she wrote this
right. This
poem. We were engaged against to some degree. And also undercounting sisters, though they certainly existed. So at the end of the poem, the regime of human sacrifice was declared finished after the Abraham-Isaac thing. But, Jessica, but what?
But the we're still in a war moment, post-war moment. People still die. This doesn't end human sacrifice. It's
right. And, of course, Oppen was himself sent away after World War II in that he left for Mexico the day after the Rosenbergs were arrested.
Because he was, in fact, a member of the Communist Party, probably.
Yeah, probably. He never actually has said as much. He tended to be very quiet about that, but did not come back until 1959 when his sister, that undercounted sister, June Oppen-Degnan, was able to arrange with the State Department essentially a promise that there would be no repercussions. And he and Fred Cody, the great bookstore owner, drove up from Mexico City together back to the U.S.
An act of support by the woman behind the male poet that would be very interesting to Rachel, both theoretically and critically.
And somebody who was very politically important. When Walter Mondale was picked by Jimmy Carter to be his running mate, he called June Oppen-Degnan before he called his wife.
Who called her?
Walter Mondale.
Walter Mondale? Well, thank you for putting that in the record. I had no idea. Randall, what were you going to say?
Well, one of the things that I think is really quite fascinating, which depends on sort of some history about Oppen having adopted this long silence poetically because he was uncomfortable with the idea of propagandistic poetry. And so he, according to Rachel, did join the Communist Party and was an active pragmatic worker for social causes. And so he... in his own thinking about the work of writing, engaged in this, as the title of the long poem suggests, in this exploration of four terms, good and bad, singularity, and numerosity. And so I think the discussion here about singletons and his sense, perhaps influenced by Kierkegaard, of vertical thinking as the correct stance toward writing, and his dissatisfaction with what he believed to be many women writers and indeed a sort of essentialist women's role of caring and being concerned with affect instead of with truth and the vertical relationship with God, I believe it comes all the way through this section on 16. And so I think the trouble in the choices line is a place where Rachel is saying this binary between the truth and compassion or activity on behalf of caring and the family is completely relevant. And I believe that's one of the main connections with section 29, which we'll talk about,
We will go
shortly.
Yes, in 1 second. Trouble in the lineage, trouble in the choices. I mean, the Kierkegaardian reading of what God asked Abraham to do is the classic choiceless choice. How could you damned if you do, damned if you don't. And that, to Rachel Blau Duplessis, through this enumerative poem, is the problem. Part of the problem and likely part of the allure traditionally of Abrahamic allegory is its stark singularity. She's looking for something numerous, so she turns to, or multiplicitous, so she turns to Oppen, who in a poem about numerosity, and he winds up quoting Kierkegaard's interest in the singularity. So she's looking, so there's a rejoinder there, and so we'll end on our discussion of 16 with the last line. Clear enough? Who wants to say something about that? Jessica?
I know that Rachel, and we all know, of course, that she's an essayist. She's a person who uses prose to really think and describe and work through. I think her poetry does that as well. And that's a rhetorical move here. Are you following me? That's part of it. But it's also, as you
what
were saying
before.
What
tone does it have, though? It's not just, are you following me?
Before we were recording, you also said this is ironic. I mean, of course it is. The story doesn't make a lot of sense. The choices don't make a lot of sense. The references, if you do not have access to them, might not make a lot of sense.
Do you think that she's actually addressing Oppen's statements about clarity that occur in Of Being Numerous? I mean, I hear that line as directly addressing Oppen.
And Ron, what about her own statements in hard copy of how she's going to really clear the decks and be clear? You know, she's really kind of calling herself on it. Randall, yes?
I think so. I mean, as she has said, that Oppen was preoccupied with this question of how do we live as part of a social species? And there's good numerosity and bad numerosity. And I think Rachel is concerned here to try to find some way in which she and Oppen perhaps can find some common ground around some sort of good numerosity.
So let's make a transition to 29, and I'll start by throwing this out, that throughout Hard Copy, Rachel Blau Duplessis, as a poet, is keen to express a desire to dismantle muse and hero figures. One of her lines in Hard Copy elsewhere is, "As for monuments, see ambivalence." So the relationship between 16 and 29 is in both cases. We have the Abrahamic monumentality of that story and the alleged end of sacrifice of people and its political failures, though theological success. And then in 29, we have Rachel going into her father's tent to steal household gods. So let's say a little more about the biblical story before we get going. Anybody? What's the significance of Rachel from the Bible? Jessica?
I'm woefully underread in the Bible, but I did, of course, in part for preparation for today, tried to figure out, well, what do people say about this particular story? And it's interesting, there is no agreed upon interpretation of why she's stolen the idols in the first place. Is it about property rights? Is it about familial religious connection? Is it something else entirely?
Sure, she steals the idols, and then when he comes after them, Laban comes after him, what does she do to keep him from finding them?
She lies. She says, I didn't steal them. She puts them in her saddle. She sits on them and refuses to stand because she's menstruating. So she says...
She doesn't say menstruation. What does she say?
Well...
In the way of women.
I am in the way of women.
According to the King James Version, anyway.
According to most versions. So what she's playing into a menstruation taboo that a male leader would respect or, you know, be afraid of, and that's where the household idols are. Is this a gesture toward theological purity, or is she becoming atheistic and dissident?
Well, I think this is a fascinating crux. She steals them in the first place because Jacob is leaving to go back to the land of his father, believing that he's been poorly treated by her father, Laban. And unbeknownst to Jacob, she steals these teraphim.
She didn't check with Jacob, her husband, before violating something basic.
Right. And so, as Jessica says, the specific reason is the matter of dispute and commentary by the rabbis, but the underlying motivation seems clear that she's interested in either the safety or the welfare of her family going forward, right? So what's interesting to me about this is that this is almost an enactment of Oppen's view of women as being more concerned with care and with affect than with truth, because she lies in order to protect her people. And I think that's a wonderful complication to what Rachel does with that, Rachel Blau Duplessis does with that in this section.
Those rare black stones, sacred knickknacks, idols, symbolic lion grabbed at that got chipped. Cover them with the ass of female claim. Settle in for the duration and refuse, being in the way of women, to rise. Say you are neither disloyal nor pilferer, and sit tight on the icons and rocks of meaning gathered from the paternal household.
Several feminist readings of Rachel in Genesis, this is chapter 31 of Genesis, right, suggest, as Alicia Ostreicher, who's written about Rachel as a kind of writer, Alicia Ostreicher refers to Rachel as an archetypal feminist writer who dares to steal across the borders of masculine culture, seize control of her cultural inheritance, and make it her own. So, Ron, why would Rachel Blau Duplessis, in the middle of hard copy, mapping Oppen's poem, which she loves so much, which is important to her, why would she respond to his section about his own daughter with the story of Rachel from the Bible?
Well, there are multiple things going on here. One is her very complicated relationship with multiple fathers in life and in poetry, George being one, her paternal father, biological father being another, herself being a feminist writer who recognizes, at least at the point she is writing this in 2007, how much she is the one woman of her generation really associated with that kind of mentoring relationship with a major male figure from that earlier generation. And also recognizing, I think, that Oppen's own comments about his daughter and about women, while not as egregious, say, as Robert Creeley's, clearly have a sense of sentimental sexism about them and throughout them. So she's actually, I think she's addressing all of those things simultaneously. One of the things that's so lovely about these two sections, this poem, drafts in general, is that Rachel starts out and approaches almost everything as, I am going to be the rationalist in poetry, replicating a move essentially that the later Oppen made as well, and manages to bring in such a wealth of concurrent references and allusions that she often has many more resonances going on than people who think they're starting with the subconscious or the most surreal are ever able to get to. So it's a source of great wealth in her work.
As she said once, I'll worry about what they mean later sometime when I have more time.
Jessica, what are your completely thoughts on this whole thing?
I wanted to add that we've mostly talked about Rachel as the figure who was mentored, as the daughter. But in fact, we can also, and she has in written about this, reverse that relationship that she brought forward, the letters in particular of Oppen. So there's something else going on here with the
and she's
taking of the idols and saving them. It's about also bringing those idols out.
It's a
again.
Gesture of resistance against the patriarchy, her own father, Rachel's own father in the Bible. It's also a preservation of
exactly.
a purer Judaism.
Neither disloyal nor pilferer.
Mm-hmm. And Rachel has also been exceptionally important and empowering for many other poets both younger than herself and even of her own generation. Yeah. I know my work in many respects is not possible at its current stage without the constant guidance from Rachel.
And I feel like as a figure in this very local landscape in Philadelphia, all of the young women poets, in my mind at least, come from Rachel. I think that's mm-hmm. an exaggeration on some level and not at all on another.
Right. So there's less trouble in
not
the lineage.
Oh, yes. Not only women.
There's less trouble in the lineage from Rachel on, you're saying.
Maybe so.
What I want to do is go around the horn twice, asking very brief, just toss it in answers to two questions. The first one is the phrase hard copy, to the extent that it either relates to the two sections we've talked about today or is just generally useful. I want to go around just to say something about the relevance of hard copy, starting with Ron, quickly.
Two things. The poem is divided into different lines. This is along a system of 19. The line of 9, of which hard copy is one, they're all related to various forms of publishing and books. And it's worth noting that in each of these, in fact, the next one is called The Book.
You mean Draft 86?
Yes, I believe it is. Not Draft 86, 19, the next line of 9.
Oh, okay.
In those terms. That's one element that I think is interesting and going on, because everything in the Draft 86 and the line of 10, as she would put it, everything is related to autobiography on each of these. So she's working these different themes systematically throughout the work. The other is at the time she wrote this, there was a very cheesy TV program called Hard Copy that was on shortly after the news that happily has disappeared probably into Hulu and YouTube forever.
Cool. I like that. You're always good for these references to, you know, pop culture or whatever Hard Copy was on TV. Rachel, you're not Rachel, you're Jessica. Say something about hard copy, the phrase, briefly.
Hard copy is horribly complicated here because, to me, hard copy is the original paper version of something. And so
the thing
if
that's
this
not
is
digital.
Original, yeah, it's not digital, but also not, it's also the original version, the one you return to for your originary reference. So if this is the originary reference, what do we do with Genesis? What do we do with Oppen?
What do we do with the draft that Oppen sent to her in 1965. Randall, quickly on the phrase hard copy, anything to add?
In addition to the wonderful things that have been said, it seems clear also that it is her laborious mapping against the Oppen of being numerous.
Hard meaning difficult.
It's a difficult kind of copy of that poem. It's not a replica. It's a different.
It's a translation.
Translation, yes. Excellent.
Yeah, good. Okay, we're going to go around again, but really briefly. This is impossible, but we have to do this. The significance of the whole project of Draft. I know it's very difficult. This is poem talk. We should be focusing on these, micro focus on these poems, but here's a chance. briefly, Ron, the significance of drafts. You've already sort of suggested it.
Drafts is one of the great American long poems. And it's interesting to note that in my lifetime, among my peers, of the other people besides myself who are working in this particular form, three of them, Rachel, Bev Dahlen, and Ann Waldman, all happen not to be men. And this is very much a form that was initially associated with all of the phallic impulses in poetry.
Great. Thank you. Jessica, drafts.
Drafts, for me personally, is a poem that, or a poem series, that teaches you something about how to read, or how you read, or how one reads, or how one might read, because it requires back and forth movement. It requires indexing. It requires reading the index. It requires reading other poets who themselves are readers. It's just very complicated, wonderfully so.
Randall.
With a nod to Ron, I would say that Drafts is the long poem par excellence of open-endedness. It's life as poem, and it discovers its destination as it goes.
And I would just add that in Drafts, one encounters many, many Ishmaels and many, many Rachels, so that trouble in the lineage becomes somewhat ironic because, in fact, the lineage is multilateral, and it goes in all kinds of unexpected directions in this draft. So as a response to the cantos, have we said pound in the last 30 minutes?
No, but
not that we're opening that can of worms, but you'll get your final word. Maybe you can do it mention pound. But the relation between drafts and Oppen is the subject today, but the relation between drafts and the cantos is another subject for another time. We're going to get final words, and I'm actually going to preempt you by inviting you to say what it was like preparing for today to be listening to Oppen and reading Rachel, or either the other way around. What do you think?
It was like essentially reading or checking a translation from one to the other. When I was reading Rachel, listening to Oppen, it was as though I were reading George's translations of Rachel. And when I reversed the two, it was exactly the other again. So it was interesting hearing George Oppen comment on Rachel's poetry from the grave.
That's so cool. In fact, a plug for Pensound that it's now possible to do that, to listen to one or the other. Jessica, final word, any final word on this topic? Something we haven't said, maybe.
Rachel is one of the most, if not the most generous teacher I've ever experienced. And I feel like as a poet and as a writer, that remains true. She allows ways into what is a very difficult poem so that the reader isn't left without any purchase, any way to get there some way.
Thank you. Randall.
Well, if I may, I'll go back to one of the sections we read today, the wonderful line, "What in the name of monotheism," which I keep mishearing as "What in the name of modernism was that about?" And she has so many double pointing lines and words here. So I think it's worth calling out what was that about is aboutness. So the tokens of meaning that the biblical Rachel takes sets up perhaps an interpretive framework, both going backward and looking forward to the later drafts about discovering how to read and what in fact meaning how it's constructed.
Terrific. Maybe it's because of the two sections that we've talked about today. Maybe that. But I think it's everywhere in drafts. I admire Rachel Blau Duplessis' sense of what someone, maybe she herself, called Creolized Jewishness.
Yeah.
And this discussion, Trouble in the Desert in 2007, is prior to Obama's election and his really bringing, you know, taking that war out of the picture to some degree. But in 2007, we had no idea. There was plenty of trouble in the desert. But Trouble in the Desert is about ignoring Ishmael. So I would say, as a final word, that she has taught me, through this part of Drafts at least, and applying it generally to her whole project, that the resolution of Judaism's founding narratives is radically inadequate in her critique because of the singularity that she points out in the Abrahamic story. It needs to be reread from the perspective of the absent Ishmael and, equivalent to him, the absent sisters. And we ignore the story of Ishmael at our, you know, at risk of great danger and trouble in the desert. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of gathering. This is intense. Yeah, get a minute or two of gathering paradise. We're going to go from trouble in the desert to paradise. Maybe it's the same place, actually, which is a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good, to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. And if you're all promised to be brief, we can get all three in maybe. So briefly, Ron, recommend something.
Right. I want to recommend the website www.saltpublishing.com, where one can actually find all of Rachel's sections of drafts. We're at a curious moment in the history of publishing and book distribution where it can be very hard to find a hard copy of hard copy unless one goes online. So I recommend Salt Publishing, just the way it sounds, and go find Rachel's work and buy all of it.
Thank you. I'm really moved by that one. That's great. And just to repeat, this draft, 85, can be found in a collection of drafts, 77 to 95, in Pitch, which is published by Salt. Jessica, gather some paradise.
I was reading around Oppen for this discussion, so I want to recommend Tom Devaney's really wonderful feature in Jacket from 2008, I think. It includes a beautiful essay by Rachel herself about her relationship with Oppen, but then also great pieces by lots of folks, including our own Al Filreis.
I was tuned out there. What are you referring to?
Never Tom mind. Devaney.
Okay. I heard my name and I figured I better pay attention. Randall.
Well, to avoid trouble in the lineage, I thought it would be worth just reminding folks of the wonderful book Poetic Artifice by Veronica Forrest Thompson, another young woman published in 1978 who was engaged in a similar very fine exploration of the analysis of how meaning is constructed from within the language of poems.
Great. And repeat the title of the book.
It's called Poetic Artifice. Veronica Forrest Thompson.
Terrific. Thank you. Well, that's all the father of everything we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests. Thanks very much to my guests. I've really enjoyed this. Jessica Lowenthal, Randall Couch, and Ron Silliman, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer today, Steve McLaughlin, and to our editor, as always, the self-same amazing, talented Steve McLaughlin. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.